the comments with the meeting. When we called for a little caucus, it's a committee caucus. It has nothing to do with joint. This is one committee. We were still dealing with the issues that were referred to the public protector and the department. And Mr. Ramburuth had responded to some issues together with the staff members. Mr. Hussein had a follow-up question that he wanted to make that is related to what Mr. Ramburuth had responded to. I'm going to give Mr. Hussein that opportunity to ask that question and then get a response, and then we'll have a way of wrapping up this matter. Can we allow that? Thank you. Mr. Hussein.
Chair, thank you for the opportunity. I refer now to the issue of mistreatment or victimization of staff. And as far back as 2009, I understand that there was a similar report or investigation conducted at the Commission with regards to mistreatment of staff. And that report made a series of recommendations. So I wanted to give the Commission an opportunity to respond to that and confirm whether or not there was such an investigation and a report produced, and the recommendations of that report, what were they and were they implemented? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Sir.
Thank you, Chair. Okay, there was in fact a 2009 incident, let's say, where there was also went through process in the organization and produced a report, and there were similar allegations, in fact, around what the current allegations are. So the answer to the question of 2009 is that report was not conclusive in finding that the allegations were indeed true.
But can you hold a meeting, Mr. Ramburuth? Who produced that report? Who's the author of that report?
We got an independent person. That's the instance in which we follow the process, internal process. Because the allegation was against me, Tembin Kosi managed that process. So I'm not going to kill it. The report, the external independent person in that instance was Mr. Sibo Pichana, who produced this report. That report did not find that the allegations were true, but made certain recommendations around the institution and how we could kind of build the team and improve skills and ensure better management. Amongst the recommendations there were, we went, following that, we went through an entire ESCO team building exercise that was very effective in kind of gelling the team together at that point. And one of the recommendations that came out of that report was that senior staff in the commission should have executive coaches to assist them in kind of dealing with the very kind of pressurized environment that we're in, that we need that kind of personal support in order to deal with the complex and complicated issues that we needed to deal with. And because of the kind of age profile of our leadership, all executive staff in the commission were then given an opportunity to have executive coaches, which all of them took up for various periods of time. So the answer to your question, Sweli, is that between the team building exercises and the executive coaching, which were designed to improve management, communication, and coherence in the leadership, those were implemented and in my view were very successful. I think the important part of your question though, and the link is, that in Tembin Kosi, that's in Bonakele, in the deputy commissioner's current complaint, more recent complaint, a lot of the things he complained about was rehashing the complaints in that earlier, in the earlier incident. Okay, so that is the kind of link. So if you read the more recent one, it's about, this happened in 2009, this happened, and most of it was what happened in 2009. So I think that's that's the short answer, but can I just say that I understand what's happening here in this committee, in that we are constantly reporting on the process of all of these things, but we're not giving sufficient information on the content and the detail of what it's all about. I mean, I think that would be leaving gaps in people's minds. So we're always talking about process, but no one's saying, well, what are the allegations? What are the issues? And I think that's the difficulty here, because we haven't also kind of reported to you on all the content of these things. And I apologize for that, but I mean, I think that insofar as there are formal processes to deal with these things, I'm constantly advised that I shouldn't break ranks with those processes and be providing information outside there. So I must apologize for doing that, but that's the advice I'm getting from the public protector, for example, saying when there was a letter, for example, from DA asking what's happening with this issue, my response was, well, let's send them the letter that went to the public protector. And upon inquiry, I was told, look, you can't do that. This is kind of in process, and it would be incorrect to do that. All the documents regarding the minister's process, there's a kind of tacit agreement that we would not reveal those to anybody beyond who's in the process, particularly because I think people were not wanting to get media speculation around this. I kept to my bargain on that, but I must state clearly that I would be perfectly happy to go through all the content and all the detail with the committee, should they require it, and with the permission of the other parties involved. I would be perfectly happy for this committee to get key documents that, if you read it, you'd get the whole picture, because there's a lot of detail here, and there's a lot of different allegations, and there's a lot of small allegations, and the idea is to get it to all add up to something, and I'm not clear what the complainant wants to add up to. Remember, I'm a party to it as well. So for the record, the four documents that I think we should be getting and making more transparent and making it open, and I'm happy with that, is the complaint by Tendi Kosi Bonakele to the minister, his letter, if you must read that and you get a picture of what he's talking about. What we've come to call the Peter Williams report, which is a report that was written to the minister following the complaint by Tendi Kosi. My response to Peter Williams' report, which was a legal response, I had to get my own lawyers, I had to appoint lawyers and pay my own lawyers, personal lawyers assist me with that. And then the letter that went to the public protector that triggered the public protector's investigation. Those four documents between them give the full story and the full picture of what happened and who said what. So I'm saying, insofar as I have any control over these documents, I'm happy for it to be out in the open. I'm going to say that I'm also kind of subject matter of some of these complaints, so that does put me in a difficult situation. But I know one thing for sure, that my greatest protection here is transparency. My personal greatest protection is when all these documents come out in the open, I'm protected personally. Because then everybody knows we're not speculating, and there's no,
Thank you very much, Mr. Ramburu. Just one last question. Where you said in September there was a mediator appointed. Who is that? In 2009, you said it's Mr. Pijana. The 2012 one, who is that?
The 2012 was a person called Angela Duplessis.
Angela Duplessis. Did she have a report?
Yeah, there is a report that she's produced. I haven't seen it, and it wouldn't be a detailed report, because in the nature of mediation is you're not doing an investigation to support, you're doing something to resolve conflict. So, but she would have, in the normal course, produced some kind of documentation around
this. Okay. Ms. Makaya, as Deputy Commissioner, do you have anything to say on this?
Thanks. I mean, you know, going back to how I was responding when the question was initially posed, I think as the institution, you know, our interest is more on achieving stability, ensuring that the institution is effective, and I think we've managed to do that so far. So in terms of the media and all of that, we've managed to contain it, to try to keep it to specific issues, and to ensure that the governance of the organization is going on well, that we still working on cases, delivering decisions, and I think that is, you know, from an institutional focus, that's our priority.
Thank you. I think we must thank also the fact that issues were raised, and they are now, you know, on the surface, and we can all interact with the issues. Thank you for the responses. The committee will then take it from here. Because the constitution allows us to do that as a committee, and the rules of the National Assembly and the joint rules together with the, let me say, the parliament rules of the two houses allow us to do that. So we will then use some of the rules and procedures to deal with some of the issues. But as of now, may we then proceed with the response to other questions? I'm aware that some questions were responded to in the meeting. Maybe there are issues that we'd want to just touch on them. Just briefly, you know, touch on and then move forward to the others. Is still yourself responding? Okay.
So I think on these, on the first question, there were a lot of issues around the human resource development policy, and I think we've covered most of those. I think in terms of the study loans, one thing we need to clarify is that the loan converts into a bursary if the person successfully completes their studies. So I think that's where the generous part was coming. It's only a loan when the person is not successful.
If you fail, you pay back.
Yeah. The right instead. So that's the only, I think, question, you know, around that. I think we can also provide statistics, you know, just showing how our graduate trainee program and our intake in general of staff has evolved in terms of the spread of universities. So I think that's all for the first question. And then in terms of the second question, and I'll also try to pick up pace a bit, there was a question around how we aligned to EDD's outcomes, how we measure impact and how and at what point impact is measured. And the EDD output specifically was employment through growth. And essentially it's challenging to measure impact within a competition policy arena because say you uncover a cartel, you prosecute the firms, they pay a fine. Then how do you then assess, you know, beyond that, what are the outcomes? And so a lot of institutions would have a system where they try to quantify the impact of all the cases and penalties. But they will do it in a very kind of rough way. So they will say for every cartel that we uncover, that saves us 10% we'll take 10% of that firm turnover to say that the positive effect that we've had because you know, prices will come down and therefore the firm is losing that 10% of profit, so to speak, therefore that's the impact. So people come up with these simple assumptions. Or they'll say in a merger case, if we prevent an anti-competitive merger, we've saved the country 10% of the combined turnovers of the firm because they would have increased prices by 10%. So there are all those kind of rough rules of thumb that international authorities use. We haven't done that so far, but we're thinking of moving along those lines. What we have done is to undertake reviews of the main sectors that we have intervened in. So we've looked at food and agro-processing, industrial products, specific industrial products, and we've gone back but doing very in-depth case studies. So in that way, we can learn from what's happened since our intervention, but of course it's difficult to generalize that that's what always happens in all cases. But the one key case that we did was in a long-running hotel in Concrete Products, where these folks had been running a cartel since the 1970s, and the cartel was bust, was uncovered, they paid a penalty, and then about 3 years later, we then went back to see what happened. And predictably, we found that prices have gone down since the cartel was uncovered. But more importantly, or as importantly, the new companies also entered into the market, because one of the ways that the cartel was operating was also keeping new entrants from coming into the market, but also keeping one another from going into each other's territory. So the Gauteng guys would think, this is our area and we're not going to go into KwaZulu-Natal, etc. So, but since that cartel has been uncovered, we find companies going into those areas that they had initially split and competing vigorously. So in that sense, from doing case studies like this and going back to see what happened since the intervention, we can see that prices come down, that entrants enter into the market. But obviously, we can't say that's always the case, but it's encouraging to see it when it happens. In this case, doing just simple pricing studies, we found that prices fell by around 37% in Durban, for instance, and 27% in Johannesburg. Of course, there's a bit of an assumption. We have to make assumptions to come up with these calculations, because we assume what would have happened had the cartel been in place, you know, taking the trend from the cartel base and projecting it, and then comparing it to current prices and saying, okay, so current prices are this much, but had a cartel trend, you know, taken forward, there would have been 30% more. So from those kinds of analysis, we can see the impact of our work, and we hope to do more of those going forward. Of course, there's a further investment of resources, but I think it's important we understand that impact. So that's something that we're focusing on. Another way that we ensuring impact is also by choosing our priority sectors, because at least in that way we can say, if we're targeting food, if we're targeting infrastructure, we're sure to you know, have a positive impact on households, we're sure to have a positive impact on the cost of doing business. So in that way, we also try to anticipate impact in that way by making sure that the way we spend our enforcement resources is those areas that are identified, you know, either by common sense or also by other policies like IPAC, as being those sectors where there's a lot of competitive harm, but also those that are important for the cost of doing business. So that's the long, you know, and the short of how we approach impact.
Thank you, Ma'am Makaya. Any follow-up question? Mr. Musa?
I want to just understand a little bit better how you actually calculate this thing of impact. I get it that you won't be able to provide an absolute, exact calculation. I mean, I can understand. But where I'm heading with it is that my concern is that when a company is charged a massive fine, 100 million rand, that they simply pass it off to the consumer and increase their prices over a period of time. And how do you, how the measures that you actually implement to prevent that from happening? Otherwise, what you're simply doing is punishing the same consumers that have been punished by the companies previously.
Just to check if you still charge 10% for you are not first time offenders, like a visual offender.
Okay, I'll come in after with the recommendation.
Okay, so on the calculation, I think, I agree that it's very difficult to come up with a precise estimate. I think, what one would hope is that in many instances it would be difficult for the company to pass on the cost to consumers. For instance, in the concrete pipes example, you have a market where, because the cartel has been uncovered, new entrants are coming in. And so the pricing power of the initial companies is undermined. And so that's one instance where, because new companies come in, even if that specific company might try to recoup its penalty, it has to compete with a broader base of competitors, and therefore it doesn't have the pricing power it used to enjoy when there was a cartel. In certain instances, the remedy itself would stop the company from being able to recoup prices. So in an extreme example, and in an example which is difficult to implement because of the way our law is structured, was in the Pioneer or the Bread Cartel case, where Pioneer paid a penalty, but also made undertaking to reduce the price of bread for a certain period. In that way, paying back customers, but not only paying back customers, also getting a reaction from other companies. So when they reduce their prices, other companies also reduce their prices. So there's a multiplier effect to it. But that's a difficult remedy to craft, because in most instances, it seems to be encroaching into Treasury's terrain, because the idea is that we impose a penalty, collect it, hand it over to Treasury, rather than trying to be creative with it. So there are limits to how much we can have remedies like that. Other remedies we've had in the past were also where we asked the company to sell off the parts of the business that's causing it to engage in anti-competitive behavior. And I say causing it where there's vertical integration and the company has an incentive because it's upstream and downstream to then exclude people downstream. So we just say, actually sell off your downstream operations so you no longer have this incentive. So once again, in this case, new blood into the industry, there's really, then they don't recoup the penalty. The new guys want to gain customers, etc. So they would also price reasonably. So I think in the way we craft remedies, we do try to ensure that that doesn't happen. But even I think in uncovering anti-competitive conduct, we're hoping that the market becomes more competitive in general, and therefore it becomes more difficult for them to recoup penalties. And I think you'll see going forward, in instances where you have an absolute monopolist, we do try for the remedy to seek to price, not always successfully. In Mittelstil, we went for excessive pricing, which would have ensured that afterwards they can't deal with price. The case that before the tribunal now on Vessel, our recommendation is about how they should be pricing going forward. So if they pay a penalty, we're hoping that if we succeed, then we would have also recommended that they price in a way that's internationally competitive and therefore not harm customers. Then on the second question on habitual offenders, yes, the policy is that when we consider a penalty, we would consider that somebody is a habitual offender and impose the maximum fine. I don't think we've had anyone recently who's been a repeat offender, but in those instances, we would recommend for the maximum fine. And then we've had other cases also recently where we have recommended for the maximum fine to be imposed.
Thanks, Member Kaya. I think what we have recommended previously is that we have to measure the impact. It's not a matter of whether you could or not. It's a matter that is required, because we are currently in a situation where we have imbalances in terms of creating an environment that is conducive for everybody to participate in the economy. And I think what I saw you doing very good was in the case of the construction industry. I think that's where people were so relaxed, didn't know that we can come in as government and try to salvage the situation, especially for the benefit of those who are not allowed to enter the market. But then the issue is, if you recall well, when we raised this issue of impact in relation to the mandate that you currently have as competition authorities, one of the mandates is to ensure that whatever, whether you charge a penalty to a company or you find the company guilty or not guilty, whatever that you do, at the end of the day, the penalty must be seen as having changed the abnormal practices. That's the correct English. Abnormal practices that are taking, place. It's correct. But then how do you correct if you penalize a person or a company, one company out of many, and business continues as usual? And those who can afford, they can afford, whether you charge 20% or 50%, they can afford and continue with the same practice. That was in light of those things that we said, we need to check. You need you to come back to us and tell us what impact are you making in terms of the work that you're doing in relation to your mandate. The reason I said I'll come with a recommendation is because we have, in the last meeting where we talked about this, recommended that it's either you utilize or it came from you yourself. You said you are about to appoint an economist who's a specialist in this kind of assessment, you know, impact assessment. You were going to appoint that person. Just want to know whether you have. If not, please ensure that you do that so that that type of work can be also integrated in the work that you're doing. But it will serve you very well. If you can't, then other countries or even other institutions, they utilize the services of our institutions of higher learning, like universities and so forth. They help you in assessing the impact. I think that way you'll be able then to know what's the next step after what you have done. Because for you to review your work, you have to have that kind of feedback. Others will be coming back and back on this, and others would be hiding behind the law and so forth. But if you allow such people to do, they will even come with recommendations on issues that you are not even aware of. I think it's upon you as a commission really to expand your work in that way. Because you can't be doing one and the same thing and not knowing what impact it has at the end of the day. That would be the recommendation from my side. I don't see any further hand. May we then proceed with the next question. Unless wanted to say something, Mem Makaya, on that.
No, thanks. I think that's fair enough. In terms of when we talked about appointing a person, the approach then we then took was more of a capacity building, where they taught staff on techniques. But I think perhaps that slows us down in it because we're hoping they would then pick it up. But perhaps the first piece that is we could think of creative ways, such as universities, to actually conduct the first few ones. I think that would be a useful way to go forward. On the next question was about whether we've done a benchmarking exercise to other competition authorities globally. And here, the various surveys that exist, that do a very comprehensive job of benchmarking us. So there's the Global Competition Review Rating Enforcement Survey. And the Global Competition Review is a media / research house that tracks the work of competition authorities throughout the year, issues newsletters, issues publications. And they rank almost all authorities globally, and they look at your efficiency, your turnaround time, the turnover of your staff, the qualifications of your staff, your resources, etc. So we find that it's very comprehensive in looking at those key measures of performance. And in past surveys, we've rated quite well. We around the 3-star rating. Actually, this year's rating came out today, and we've maintained a 3 stars, 3 out of 5 stars, and that's considered good. So we're in the same tier as Russia, Portugal, Denmark has gone down this year, Switzerland, Sweden. So these, as you can see, these are also mostly authorities that are about 10, 20 years old, medium-sized countries. Countries like Sweden, which you are quite advanced in many ways in terms of economic analysis. So I think from that perspective, we could say that we've done well in terms of our benchmarking, but obviously the exercise also usually highlights areas of improvement. So for instance, in this year's survey in assessing South Africa, one point that came through was that we could be doing more in terms of our abuse of dominance cases. We're doing a lot of cartels, doing them successfully, preventing anti-competitive mergers, and they had very good things to say about our merger assessment provisions and the way we conduct merger assessments. But in terms of abuse of dominance, they see that as an area of improvement, and we also see it as an area of improvement. So you know, it's useful to get that kind of feedback. And I just, there's also a global murder control index, and there we've also been found to perform quite well, because I think it's generally felt we do very good assessments, we meet our merger timelines, we don't have any major complaints or major reviews of our merger decisions except in one or two instances. So I think from those kinds of surveys, we get interesting feedback. But we also kind of take that data, analyze it in more detail, and see where we are in terms of global benchmarks.
Just why education? What constitutes the best benchmark? And I understand what you're saying here. But would there be any country that would say would no one benchmark was such a worst example to benchmark against? Understand what I'm saying? Let me try my English again. Okay. You mentioned a few countries there that you said you are on the same power, Brazil, Russia, Pujan. But I'm saying, would you mention maybe one country that you say presents the best scenario that you can, but then there's another one that is you wouldn't want to benchmark against, what's the worst? Presents the worst picture. Is that clear now?
Who decides on the benchmark, on the countries to be involved?
Okay. So in terms of the main one, the GCR one, it's an independent company that looks at that covers almost all authorities. So it covers all authorities, basically competition authorities across the world. And the way they would do their survey would be to go to each country, they interview journalists, so they ask us for the top 10 journalists that cover competition issues, and they interview consultants working in that country, and they interview leading advocates and lawyers, practitioners working in that country, and then come up with a picture of what is going on in terms of how practitioners experience our turnaround time, how they experience the quality of our decisions, whether they're constantly taking us for appeal, etc. So all of them come out from those interviews. And then they have a methodology to then compare across countries what they would consider to be the outperformers and the not great performers. In terms of the rankings, the best are predictable in a way. So the best are the EU, the Directorate General for Competition, which is the EU-wide competition policy. It's the US. The US is a very different system from us, where the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission, deal with different kinds of anti-competitive conduct. But it also goes through the normal courts. And so it has a very different dynamic to it. At the same time, they're also quite advanced when it comes to economic analysis. They had, I think, their biggest collection of PhDs in economics, for instance, in the world. So that kind of sets them apart. They're very different markets. So the US, EU, the UK also ranks quite at the top. France would be the one country where it's small and it has a very different attitude towards economic policy, more, I suppose, center-left, and a different approach to competition policy. I think they're the ones that are slightly different from the rest, but also seen as performing at a very high level. Because I think there seems to be, there'll always be a tendency towards countries that are very much about traditional, neoclassical economics. That prevail in these competitions, but France is the one that's slightly different but is acknowledged as being a good performer nonetheless. The Asian agencies rank the same as us, more or less, 3 stars, 3.5 stars. They only rank up to 2 stars, so I guess the ones that are unranked are ones that, we wouldn't necessarily, would say, they're peers. So unfortunately, because in the rest of Sub-Saharan Africa, the agencies are quite new. Most of them are not ranked yet. But I think that's more a reflection of their age, because we're seeing authorities in Kenya, Namibia, that are quite good, but I think that it's just a question of experience. There are some agencies in Asia which are also quite tokenistic in that they don't quite take competition policy seriously, but they do it for World Bank loans, etc. So those jurisdictions, the Vietnam, Papua New Guinea, also don't really get ranked. But I think it's also because very ceremonial in the way they approach competition policy. So those would be kind of the bottom end.
Okay.
Just on that global review, the previous time we were assessed, we had, what, 3.5 staff, and now we have 3. So we dropped half the staff.
Sorry, so that was two years ago. So we were 3.5, and then we dropped last year to 3, and then we remained at 3 this year.
Oh, okay. And
so, we did drop at 2 years ago.
Okay, but the question I want to ask is that if we had dropped half a percentage point or half a star, whatever you want to refer to it, they must have made some, provided some reasons why we went down and made a couple of recommendations. Are we attending to that so that you can move to 5 stars at some stage?
I think so. I think that, you know, one of them even back then was about abuse of dominance, that we're still a bit too biased towards the Patels and not so much abuse of dominance. And I think, yes, and then they made comment about our average age, which is also difficult, you know, given...
What's changed?
Average age, yeah. So I think compared, like, the U.S. average age is about 45, which I think just in our country, the average age is 25 in general. So it's those kinds of difficulties. And also, at that time, we were having legal challenges in terms of, you know, people taking us to the Constitutional Court on procedural issues. And a lot of that managed to overcome a bit. So, you know, recent constitutional cases have found in our favor. But I think we did go through a bit of a difficult period where a lot of our decisions were taken on appeal. So that was one of the big issues. And that was around the time of Walmart, where there was a lot of negative sentiment created about the competition regime in general in South Africa.
Yeah, we will say race is normally related to that. What's the current affairs? What's happening at that time? So they might not necessarily be related to the institution itself, although they do. It's just that sometimes they become very subjective. I think that's what we've learned through time. May we continue to the next issue? Those that you can just rush off, please do so. Especially those that don't need a lot of cost of time. I think we are at 12 o'clock and we're supposed to be on another item by now. We will finish the competition commission today, for sure. We can then postpone the other matter, but what we must know is that by 1 o'clock we must have wrapped up everything. Thank you.
Okay. So the next question was about when we conclude settlement agreements, do we include the consumer ombudsman? I think that we can deal with quickly because not usually, because in our policy we've separated consumer and competition issues. So in most instances, if we're going to settle a case, it's been determined to be a competition matter with very limited consumer issues, and therefore we would handle it in that way. But of course, there's a bit of an overlap sometimes, and when there is, we would refer those complaints that are substantially about consumer issues to the Consumer Commission. So we do have referrals between the two institutions. But when a case evolves and it starts getting investigated, a call usually tends to be made. Is this substantially competition or is this substantially kind of consumer ombudsman type issues? The next question was about the spread of ownership. And how we've achieved that. And there, I suppose, you know, we also refer the response to question two, where the sort of ownership was something that obviously we're very concerned about in terms of if we're uncovering anti-competitive conduct, a lot of that conduct would be about excluding people from the market. So in the way, you know, as I mentioned again, there we can, in the way that we craft remedies, we would try to have remedies that deal with that. For instance, once again, in the Pioneer case, part of the settlement was that $250 million would be given to an agro-processing fund that would be administered by the IEBC, which had been set up but we're still following up on the kind of disbursements that they've made, but they've made some disbursements. The same was with Walmart, with the Walmart merger, where one of the conditions imposed was the opening or the setting up of funds to develop small business. So in those types of remedies, we try to explicitly, introduce measures that would facilitate the spread of ownership. However, we also want to emphasize that by challenge anti-competitive conduct, even implicitly, you know, in reducing input costs, in breaking up cartels, we're creating the opportunity for new companies to enter. Now, sometimes that opportunity is not taken up because of other reasons. So, for instance, even in the agro-processing funds that I talked about, you know, as we continue to monitor them, we'll see if they're able to disperse those funds in the time that's been given, whether they're able to find those opportunities. Because a lot of times, funding agencies struggle to find entrepreneurs because of other reasons unrelated to competition. But insofar as we can try to create the opportunity with our remedies and with our enforcement, we do. Then the next question was about,
let's pursue this one because it's very important. You say it's very difficult sometimes to find, let me not dwell on that. Let me ask a question in relation to the very same conditionality. You say you are busy checking the progress in terms of the conditions that have been put. Who is doing? Have you set up a structure that is looking into that? And the time frame that you've given, for instance, by when should this money, you know, should have been distributed, you know, to those people that are in need of? I just want to find out that. And so that we are clear what time frames we're dealing with here, because it's not something that should be forever there. Is it increased? Is it still 100? Is that the 100 million that we're talking about? How much was it?
So there was 260 million for Pioneer agro-processing, and then there was 200 million for Walmart.
For Walmart, yeah. Yes. How far is that? Can you just give us the thing so that we know in terms of the monitoring part of it from your side? How far are you? What is serving as a hindrance in terms of distributing those monies? What are the challenges that perhaps as committee members we could face? We're coming from various constituencies here. And whether there's been any advertisements or people know that they need to access that money, and how is that communicated to them so that, you know, we can help in that process.
So in these two cases, these are different cases. So in the Walmart case, in the merger case, we have a very well-established merger monitoring unit that monitors our conditions. And in that one, it's still a new fund. So we are trying to communicate, or rather MathMart is trying very hard to communicate of the existence of the fund, but we would welcome more kind of wider dissemination about what the fund is about. It's still new. It's only been set up about 6 months ago formally, even though the condition has been discussed for 2 years. Only now has the structure been put in place. So I think there, it's still very early days. There's an annual report that the company is meant to provide to us, and they've also given us interim reports. But because it's so new, the report only at the moment talks to how the fund is set up, the governance, and also the criteria that for companies to qualify. And obviously it would be in areas that are in food and manufacturing and in areas that MathMart will be able to support, or in MathMart value chain, those products that they would need in their value chain is what they're focusing on. We've been very... we've been very vocal with them to tell them that this should be in addition to what they would ordinarily do, and that this should create new jobs, new enterprises. It shouldn't just be business as usual. And they've undertaken that they'll demonstrate that in their reports going forward.
How do they give you even the processes, the procedures in terms of accessing of this fund, because it's very important, and who finally decides on which enterprise should get them. I think it's very important that we know those issues, that we get that information.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. My other question here is especially around the conditions. Are we not, I must confess I don't know the conditions properly, but I will be very scared of conditions which will further entrench the monopoly of Massmart in the South African economy. I have picked up that they are going around getting spaza shops and the small shops to link into their value chain. So that it looks like if we are not very careful, all the shops and all the spaza shops will end up being conduits for Massmart. So that it's like they are the salesperson for Massmart. So we must ask ourselves whether that is in the interest of the country economically. But maybe you are closer to these issues if you could clarify me. And seemingly to the spaza shop, the spaza shop will see an opportunity because they will say to the spaza shop, we will come and brand your shop, we will come and deliver, we will bring stock for you. So we may end up with a country that's owned by a investment.
So on the first question, on the how the fund operates, I must say the way the Competition Appeal Court order was written is such that they only inform us and report to us at the end of the process how they've dispersed and whether they've met the condition. But we're not involved in the actual mechanics of the fund itself. How it works is that there's an executive committee that takes decisions. And that committee has a representative from EDD. I know the DG of Economic Development sits on that. There's a representative from Labour, from SACAO. And there's also a representative from the Small Business Forum. And so they get together and almost become a fund committee where then they decide how the disbursements are made. And I suppose for us, it's for us to come at the end of it and to say, were they faithful to the initial intentions of the fund, but we're not quite involved in the actual decision-making. But that structure was intended to be broad-based, to take care of all the different policy questions that were raised in the transaction. In terms of other conditions and change Massmart dominance, I think the way they were crafted were around the fact that Massmart was not meant to create a value chain that replaces what already exists. So a value chain that supports those small businesses rather than just displacing them. So hopefully the intention would be that when this fund is completely dispersed, those small enterprises that benefited from them would be sustainable. And that's one thing that we would be looking into, that it's not that they simply collapse when the fund ceases to exist. They should have been empowered to be able to be viable businesses. I think there's a broader question in general about retail in South Africa and how it is that, you know, that the big four, five chains are encroaching, you know, across the country. I don't know if they're encroaching, but they're certainly going into areas that they were traditionally not operational in, and it's changing the retail landscape in many areas. And it is a policy question, but I think that goes a little bit beyond the Massmart issue, because it is about the pick and pay, the shop rights, everyone trying to establish themselves in as many areas as possible, because clearly I think, you know, the traditional suburban areas are saturated. But I think that's a broad question of retail policy. With this fund, certainly what we want to see are sustainable small businesses in communities, and I think we will hold them to that.
I wanted to come to that so that what Mavas is concerned about, extension of Walmart, Massmart, you know, chain stores up to the level of a kiosk out there down there. No, the conditionality, as far as I understand them, is to help because the concern then was Walmart must measure going to discontinue, you know, those small businesses at the location there. And then what it then says, strengthen those, support them so that they can stand out, not to stand as your extension, but be a standalone enterprise, no matter how small it is. So what he's trying to say is that we should cut against that, so that at the end of the day when we report, we say, even when you question them, we say, but here, is it you or is it a local business person, you know, be able to check those things.
Yeah, because here we, I think indeed it is a big question which we can't afford to make a mistake on as a country, because it will mean that unconsciously as government we will be supporting Masnat, Walmart above other business entities, and we may end up with an unintended consequence where all the spaza shops, I'm just taking spaza shops as an example, all of them race to link to what seemingly are opportunities. So when we say yes, seemingly opportunities, it is our duty to make sure that that's what we need as a country. So I really have a very serious reservations. It could be because of ignorance. And while we are on this, maybe we must invite this fund committee so that we engage it and understand it properly. Thanks.
Thanks. I mean, I agree. I think you should definitely engage with the fund committee to try and understand how they, you know, are making this real in practice. I think one of the conditions in the fund that might be useful is that we, it's set up that the beneficiaries from the fund are not restricted to only dealing with MedMart. And it's also been said in a way that they should be empowered to be able to be suppliers or business partners to any of other retailer or any other company. So there isn't this exclusivity that we give you money and you work for us. It's more we creating businesses, and if you want to deal with other retailers or other suppliers, you should also be able to do that. So we are trying to break that dependence on one company. Okay. Then going
the second one is that is the 260
yes.
Of the
IDC Agro Processing Fund.
Yeah, that came from
Pioneer.
Yeah. How is that going?
It's managed by the IDC. We haven't had, we've had initial reports. We haven't had a follow-up report recently, but we'll follow up on that. I think when we did have the first report, our only concern, which we did raise with IDC, was that the fund was intended to support entrants in particular areas and particular value chains that had been hurt or damaged or excluded by the cartel's behavior. But then the funding should be wider than that. So I think they were funding maybe avocados when it's about the bread and milling value chain. But we're also not sure if we should stress that, because I suppose if you find agro-processing entrepreneurs coming with ideas in avocados, say that we insist that it has to be about the milling value chain could also be problematic. So we are still grappling with that issue. Okay, then on the next question, there was a slide where we talked about increasing sophistication of the environment, and there was a question as to what that means. And I must admit, this is probably one we can dispose of quickly, because this was a slide that was summarizing what you know, the author of the strategy had identified as the external environment, and they had thought that there's increasing sophistication in the external environment, either because people are becoming to know more about competition law and presenting more complex cases, more challenges. But it was in that context of when the strategy for 2007 to 2010 was being developed it was thought that the commission was facing an increasingly sophisticated external environment, and the strategy had been crafted to respond to that. Whereas I think the strategy before that had just been about setting the institutions and the structures. I think that was what the comment was about. Then we asked a question on slide 11 about which sectors are included in food and agro processing. And so we just listed all our cases in terms of the different subsectors there. And we asked further questions around impact. And so we talk about the Pioneer settlement again as to how we try to ensure impact in that case, but also that in general, by challenging anti-competitive behavior in all these subsectors, we'll see more entry and competition in the years that follow after that. Then we asked about how we measure our objectives and outcomes and how we quantify this. And this, I think this is also a good one. In terms of our annual performance plan, we set targets which are then monitored through our internal and external audit processes. But of course, in terms of outcomes, I think I'll refer you back to the discussion on impact assessment that we just had. And then there was a question about adverse court decisions and how this impacts upcoming cases. And there we've just listed some of the main adverse cases that were creating difficulties in terms of procedure and process. And we just gave an update of where they are. And so we talked about the launch home matter, where once again it was more about detailed procedural issues around how, and I don't want to go into the details of all of these cases, but it's often about how we frame a complaint and how that complaint gets investigated and then gets referred to the tribunal. And of course, there's often a change, which you'd expect during the investigation. But there's always been concerns around, well, if you don't tell us at the beginning that this is what you're investigating, how do you protect ourselves as respondents? All those due process issues. And I think when we've been able to take those cases further, like in the 7th matter, we went to the Constitutional Court, we have, and we found positive outcomes. In other cases, we've decided not to take them forward for, you know, for various reasons within those cases after taking advice. And there are instances where we do accept that, you know, those cases highlight important things about our processes that we should tighten up and improve. And so in some instances, that the approach that we take that, yes, it might be tedious, but if there's a substantial change during an investigation, we will issue a new initiation statement, or we will amend initiation statement where it's feasible and where the law guides us in that way. But if it's not, if it's prejudicial to the case and it's not warranted, then we won't and we'll pursue the case in that manner. I think we found a happy medium where the courts have clarified issues, such as in the syntax matter, but also in other matters where we thought perhaps the solution is more internally focused and also changing our processes accordingly. So that's a summary of the adverse decisions up to that stage that we had highlighted in the report.
There's a follow-up from the first half. I don't know whether I'll be asking a question on 7 because I which 7 and 9. Okay, what about this Memakaya? We just slow sometimes. Bear with us.
Thank you very much. I just had a question of clarity. At number 7, the last paragraph, you talk about arrangements were made for half of this amount to be set aside for the creation of agro-processing competitiveness fund. Just how you go about doing that? When I remember the earlier comment in a response to a previous question that Mr. Rambo replied, where he said you collect the funds and you have to pass over to Treasury. But in this particular case, you kind of changed the, which is positive, but I'd like to hear how you managed to do it, because the law provides for you to do something else, as I understand it. And then on number 8, I'm sorry, number 9, you did say that these are some of the main cases that they were adverse findings, which means these are not all of them. And that's how I'm interpreting it. And which then takes me to this question, and that is, if you don't have the information now, I understand, what's the average or the cost of the adverse findings? Because I'm sure they must be quite heavy legal cost, considering that the Lanthong matter went all the way to the Constitutional Court and back to CAC, and so there must have been quite a substantial amount of costs involved there. So do you have the figure available that gives a bit of a guidance or an idea of what is the total cost of money that was spent on adverse cases as opposed to those that we have positive findings? Because in a way that's an indication of the success of the work that you've been doing. I mean, just to elaborate the point a bit, if you spend 100 million rand and you're getting successes, there is a very positive outcome and snowball effect somewhere down the line. If you're spending 100 million rand on adverse findings, you're not going to recover that money. So, if you could just speak to that point. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Any other? Judge Mother.
Mine is not directly on this, but it's a follow-up on what I asked before. So I don't know whether that will jeopardize the meeting's time or whether I can
ask.
My biggest worry is that with the fund that is created, I personally don't think that MassMart should be involved in the execution of the fund in whatever manner. If the policies have been set, then there should be other people who then distribute the funds in a way that is guided by the principles. But at that stage, MassMart and Walmart should take a position, like a position that is taken by any economic player. That's my worry, that if that is not taken care of, then we cannot say that the spotters and the small shops will choose who they do business with. They will be influenced to do business with the person that seemingly gives them money. That's my worry. And it is going to kill. It is going to be anti-competitive in the long run, and because it will, the players at the level of the Massmart are going to be killed by Massmart and Walmart. Thanks.
Thanks. No, I thought your recommendation that we meet with the fund committee was going to address the issue that you raised. Okay, thanks. Any other? No. Okay, my question that I said I wanted to ask was in relation to 7, because when we asked that question, it was mainly to understand, because we were checking up on the issue of pricing, whether your intervention, did it really have an impact on the pricing itself or not. You did indicate that you don't have authority because of the law, the provisions in the current legislation. You cannot therefore make any impact in terms of pricing. The only way is to penalize. That's what the response we got from ourselves. But then we were saying, in a household that knew that the bread was 5 rand, that was the consumer price, 5 rand. And after the collusion, the bread is 10 rand. You uncover it, but then in that process you penalize. The price is still at 10 rand. It hasn't still up is still affecting that poor household by being 10 rand. So the market price now is set at 10 rand. What would have been your impact? Because that poor household that can only afford the bread of 5 rand is not in any way in any business. They won't benefit from that 260 million because they're not in any form of business. So wouldn't you say that therefore that this is another trust, whether set up in a collusive manner or what, but still it has influenced the market. It has influenced the market. The bread between 2000, if for instance the bread was going to be 10 rands in 20, maybe between 2013 and 2015, is 10 rands between 2012 and 2013. How are we going to make up that by 2015 the bread is still 10 rands? Because at any rate, that was supposed to be, it was projected to be 10 rands at that time, if there was no collusion. I don't know if you understand that question, because that's just the gist of our question when we asked it, as to what the breakdown in terms of what makes, you know, the food industry in this case, like the milling. If you don't understand it, please say so that they can, because this is as clear as I thought I could clarify it.
Okay. So perhaps start with how we did the agro-processing fund. This is a fund that's now being administered by the IDC. And yes, that was difficult because when we imposed that remedy, immediately afterwards, Treasury did raise its objections and, you know, sought legal representation, came to make presentations before the tribunal as to why this can't be. And I suppose, and you know, they were in their rights to do so because we are only mandated to act in certain ways. And in that instance, an agreement was reached that the money would be handed over to Treasury, and Treasury would then commit to handing it over to the IDC for the fund, and that's more or less how it was done. So it was through Treasury. And that's why I also said these kinds of remedies would be difficult because of that very reason, because one would always have to then get the buy-in of Treasury that's the most appropriate way of dealing with it. And in future, they could easily say, no, we think it should go to something else. So yeah, there are limits to those kinds of remedies.
I mean, I think just to add to that, I think this is an important debate that we've kind of constantly had and come up with. That is, you know, the notion that here's a competition authority that is finding something went wrong, but its remedies are not benefiting directly those people who have been disadvantaged. And I mean, that's a fair point, you know. It's like we're just kind of finding people, putting the money in the fiscus. What about the person that's been disadvantaged here? And I mean, there's two issues to, that's a fair question and a good question, but there's two issues in the broader governance that you need to take into account. The one that Chile's covered is that in the view of Chile, who made legal representation in the tribunal on this, opposing us doing this. In other words, they were opposed to the commission taking it upon itself to decide how the fine would be distributed amongst those who were disadvantaged. And their argument is that according to the appropriation bill, only Parliament has the right to decide how monies get allocated. Nobody else does. You're going way beyond your mandate here. We understand your sentiment. We understand what you're trying to do, but you don't have the right to do this. If Parliament decides that the best way to use that money was to set up nursery schools, so be it. But we can't decide what to do with it. And that was a very powerful and tight legal argument, which we have to accept. And of course, Treasury was also concerned that if every government department, local authority now started setting up its own fund and started skiving money off the fiscus to start doing its own thing, there would be no order and governance would fall down. So I think that's the one argument. The other thing to note is that this, in the structure of our Act, our fine, our penalty is an administrative penalty. You know, it's not, it's a bad example, I know, but it's akin to a parking ticket, a speeding fine. It's meant to be a disincentive for firms to behave in a particular way. So fine is to disincentivize you to behave in a way, just like a speeding fine is a disincentive for you to speed. When you collect the speeding fine, you're not handing it out to all the people that were disadvantaged by your speeding. Okay? But the way our act is designed is there's meant to be a second process once a decision of the authorities are taken. Once there's a decision from the authority that something, law has been broken, those parties that have been disadvantaged by that then have the right to claim legal damages at the High Court. And it is that step that does the reparation thing. It's that step that kind of does give justice to those people that might have been disadvantaged. And unfortunately, we've been here for too short a while. We haven't got to a stage where that has become big practice. Because the South African legal system does not have a history of class action like the U.S. where people get together and take that. So that is something that still needs to develop in our system, where disadvantaged parties use the opportunity given to them by the Act to claim damages.
I think, before I come in, my
follow-up is that I would have thought it is in the interest of the Commission to incentivize the whistleblowers. The whistleblowers are those that have suffered, so that they must feel that as a result of having noted that harm has been done to us, a crash, correctly so, is being built for us. You know, that becomes an incentive for everybody else to work with you, to help you, alert you to some of these things. But if the benefit goes to an invincible person, then the affected communities, the harmed communities, will not be incentivized. But the second point is that it becomes a class issue again. Because once we talk High Court, what was caught, it means we are seeing only the very rich and the richest, and only the market suburbs will be able to make a claim. We may as well forget about the people whose interest we are trying to call to.
Thanks. I think it's related, because I think if you say you take a class action, who's going to pay? Who will be the, that time I'm the initiator, but then their legal cost, who's going to be? Legal aid, we don't always tell you we don't have, we run out of funds. Will the competition authorities be able to finance that? It's another thing. So it's about also educating our people, because they might even not know that, I think we're raising this for the second time, that they have, you know, such an option to take. But then what needs to be clarified in that process of education is, where do you go, for instance, if you want to commence a class A? I agree that I would have a situation where consumers would say, no, it's too much. We want the price to be 5 rand and take that to the cost. For instance, price of bread to be 5 rand, because that's a staple food, and this is a necessity, you know, for every household, 5 rand. And then where do we start? If there is a legal provision, but how do we effect that legal, you know, provision? These are some of the things that I think, as the people who are dealing with this issue, should investigate and be able to educate us afterwards as to what, you know, in terms of the processes and procedures, how do we follow those procedures. I think this is something that you could give yourself at homework and look at it and then come and advise us. If it's something that needs to be, it's a policy direction or policy decision something that we can be able to influence, inform us, so that we are able to do so.
Okay. I mean, I think that's very important, and then we'll take it as homework. I think there are two cases. I think the whole damages issue is also about the system developing. You know, in the U.S., you already have a system where lawyers would take on a class action for free, not for free, for a percentage of the award. So in a way, you don't, you know, there's no issues around costs, etc. But it's a system that's taken decades to develop. And so I think there are two developments here that can set us on that way. The Bread Cartel, there are attempts to get a class action going, led by BlackSat and other NGOs. And that's kind of going through the courts at the moment. They're trying to get certified, because you need to be certified as a class that has an interest in the matter. So I think that's an interesting one to watch, and I think to support as it makes its way through the courts, because that would be kind of the first big one that comes through.
Is it for sure? Maybe we need to call BlackSat.
Yes. I think that would be quite useful. And then the second one is actually the construction fast-track settlement process. Because as we conclude the settlement, you know, one of the challenges of damages is often to demonstrate that you've been harmed. You know, it's not taken for granted. So even when you have a class action, you still have to establish in court that you're the parties that have been harmed by the conduct in question. Construction provides a case where that's an easy hurdle to overcome. You have a very definitive group of government departments, municipalities that have clearly overpaid, et cetera, the case can easily be made. So we are hoping that once the settlements are finalized at the tribunal, the next step would occur in this case with some government departments and municipalities seeking damages. I think that would also help to develop the law. So those are two developments which we think might, you know, kickstart the process.
One very quick point on this, and that is, let's not assume that all damages claims will be class action type claims. You know, in the case of Bread, the people that were disadvantaged were hundreds and thousands and millions of individual consumers out there, so you do class action. But in a lot of cases where there would be a party disadvantaged, it won't be such a large class of people. Usually, in the first instance, it's another firm that is disadvantaged. So it's a big enterprise that has the ability to hire a lawyer, or it's a government department that has the ability to hire a lawyer. I mean, so while in all instances the ultimate loser is the consumer, there are intermediaries that lose in between that have the ability to claim such damages. And the difficulty, as Speedy points out, is for those firms to then prove that they were indeed disadvantaged, and then to prove the extent to which they've been disadvantaged, to work out what damages claims they're going to make. And I think one of the snags or difficulties there is a lot of these firms that are disadvantaged just pass that disadvantage on to the end consumer. So they're not really disadvantaged.
That's the demand for them. The consumer is at disadvantage, because at the end of the day, the price, we suffer the price difficulties, you know.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you have intermediary, I agree, but the end person is the consumer. How then does the consumer join the intermediary in claiming? I think those are the things that really need to work on, Mr. Ramboros, and as a commission, to help us. We are here to help the people. Yes. But I wanted also to bring in the fact that in that issue, it will be unfair of me not to bring it, so that you also understand it. We understand it that as a commission, the PFMA demands that anybody who collects also deposits into the fund, that is the treasury fund, what you call it, national revenue, yes. So I think it's in that regard that they did not want you to. But at the same time, you can request, because what they do, they project the income. So when they project, it's because you said you're going to, you're projecting also to raise so much money. So whatever they plan on is based on what you projected together with others. So But if you come and say, all what we projected now we're going to be putting it somewhere, you are disadvantaging that collective fund. So maybe it's important that together with the department, you work out another means of saying, for whatever we collect, if we can take 10% of it and put it into the fund. I don't think that could be, could not be granted. And that would form part of the request by Treasury to say, in case of competition authorities, because of their nature of work, this is what they are requesting, whether it's 5%, 10%, or whatever, of whatever you collect it. So they would put that into their planning. So that I don't think would not be granted if you would approach it that way. Is this just a recommendation on your side? If really that fund, we see it as very important though, that one. If you want to make that fund work for the benefit of consumers and whoever that is being at a disadvantage, you may want to approach that in that way, your revenue collected in that way. Okay.
Okay, then.
The other questions that, like I said, they were responded to, but that needed further clarity. You are now on question number
10,
left with 5. And I can see number 10 that we spend a lot of time on it. And I don't think there's any member who wouldn't want to, unless there's a follow-up. Yes, Mem Sute.
The two points on that one, Chair, that when you talk about the performance bonus, if you can have your criteria to evaluate and measure the performance, avoiding the tick of boxes, but have a full report guided by the criteria as to why this person is awarded whatever, and also get the amount of performance bonus. And the other one, the length notice for one to resign, so that you don't have people acting for 6 months or more. You know, in itself, it raises expectation if you act a person for a long time. And if something doesn't happen, it affects your performance. What would be the reasonable time for one to, for what is for her resignation?
Any other?
Okay, thanks. I think on performance bonuses, we will provide our policy and the statistics on how we've allocated over the previous years. I mean, we're guided by our performance management policy in doing this, so we would have different banks of scores, and according to those scores, we would then award different percentage of bonuses accordingly. So we can provide the policy and the later steps on that. The length of notice for resignation, I think it's standard across the commission, 1 month notice. And I think we take the point about acting positions that, you know, sometimes we struggle to fill positions necessitating people to act for long periods, but we do try to mitigate that in terms of trying to improve our recruitment, trying different recruitment methodologies to try to limit that. But I think that's a point that's well taken.
Thank you. You have a follow-up, Minister Hussain?
Yes, Chair. My question is precisely that what term will we have, how can I put it? I mean, for you to get replacement, I don't think 1 month is enough for you to embark on recruitment and give the skills that you will be looking for.
I think we'll internalize that point. I think we would perhaps need to think about other ways to lengthen the notice period, if it's possible, within labour legislation. But I think that's something that would certainly benefit the institution.
Okay. Are you satisfied, messages?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Peck.
Yeah. Chair, I'm not going to be controversial. I'm dealt with all this. The difficult parts, but you haven't responded to the question of the cost of the adverse finding.
On the adverse finding, once again, I don't have the statistics offhand, but we can provide the statistics on how much you spend on adverse litigation and on positive litigation. I think you know, you have to be very careful in mind the way one interprets them, because there are lots of business as usual processes that happen in the commission that we've mastered, that therefore seem to have lower legal costs, simply because they're routine, you know, issues like mergers, defending mergers, etc. Whereas the difficult cases would be 4 or 5 cases that take a great bulk of legal resources. So there is a bit of an interpretation issue there. That sometimes you want to follow, you want to establish a principle in law where there's no clarity in the law as to how you want to proceed, and you take it all the way to the Constitutional Court, and it might be one case, whereas you're processing 50 mergers, you know, over a quarter, and it costs you almost nothing. So I think there's just that point in interpreting the statistics that one would have to bear in mind, but we'll provide the statistics. Then question 11 was about the new powers. These are the market inquiry powers. I think we've also responded to a question about the market inquiry itself. So I think perhaps that we can quickly go through with. Eventually, we have the powers to conduct market inquiries formally now, rather than having to rely on voluntary participation in the past. And the first inquiry is going to be in healthcare. And we've published a terms of reference on our website, where we're trying to get industry and other stakeholders and regulators, etc., to have input into that. And we would welcome also guidance and recommendation from the portfolio committee on the issues that market inquiry specifically will be looking at. So there we've just reproduced some of the highlights of the terms of reference. The comments, and we've extended the period, so we're receiving comments until the 25th of June as we speak. And then from there, we'd be setting up the structure for the inquiry. We set aside, we have a project plan. We're hoping to start in September. And that will involve setting up the panel that will hear the inquiry, and also a technical team that would then conduct the inquiry. And all of that is in process. We've also issued expressions of interest for certain technical skills that we think will require during the process. And we will be, the tender will close soon, I'm not sure of the exact date, on the 11th of June. And from there, we're hoping to then set up the structure for the inquiry. It will take about 18 to 24 months because this is a very complex market. But we're hoping, I mean, this is going to be something that we do as a matter of course. So we'll have other inquiries in other years. Some will take 6 months, some will take 3 months. You know, this is a power that we have and that we want to utilize as optimally as possible. So we will be trying to embed the skills of how to conduct a market inquiry within the commission.
I guess there will be a time when when we call on the commission to come and brief us, just on various different inquiries that you are conducting, because this is just for the purposes of the what you'll be doing in this financial year. Yes. But then we would want you to brief us on what you are doing currently and how far and why you decided on that. Okay.
The next question. The next question was a reduction in fee income. That's a simple one. We only get fee income from, most of the fee income we get is from mergers that are notified. Large and intermediate mergers attract a fee, and obviously that's driven by the market. The other fees we get are very small fees for advisory opinions. Once again, that's also driven by the market. How many people ask for advisory opinions, and also how many mergers are filed in a year, how big the transactions are, and that will determine the fee income. So it's more what the demand is from the public. And obviously to reduce economic activity, if there's a merger boom, then our fee would increase. Then the next question, how does the commission monitor compliance with merger conditions? I think we've dealt with this. We do have a merger monitoring unit, and we keep those stats so we can give you the latest statistics in terms of all types of conditions, including job-related conditions. And then the next question was about two deputy commissioners. So at this, when we came the last time, I think it was the last week or the last month of Thembinkosi's term, and we had already, the two of us, been appointed, so there were three commissioners. But that overlap only lasted for a week. And then going forward, there were only two deputy commissioners, and I think they were both budgeted for. Because that's always been a vacancy in the organogram to have two deputy commissioners.
Yeah, but the question was related to how are you going to justify the payment of a third commissioner while you have budgeted for two. That was the gist of the question.
And that overlap lasted only for a week, and it was to ensure handover from
so
the outgoing.
Commissioner that's not going to be paid for a week.
Okay.
Yeah, actually you are right. Because for that particular one, we meet somebody that two people that we meet. So the main question is that it's around financial insecurity.
Mm.
And they budget later to that.
Thank you, Chair. I think, yes, it is a small amount versus the amount that we had budgeted for the whole year for the deputy commissioner that was not there. So we were able to cover the 1 week. Yeah, we saved because we didn't have a deputy commissioner.
In my opinion, is the under expenditure because you could not perform, couldn't appoint a third commissioner. It's underperforming. Yes. Irrespective of who appoints, by the fact that you budgeted for someone you didn't have. Yes. But then you paid for someone who's not working, who's not supposed to be working. Again, which is not correct.
That's fair.
The principle here is doing the right thing, not utilizing the money that you have for the wrong reason. It's the principle. Okay.
Okay. I think we know that, and I think those are fair comments. Okay. And then the last question was about what initiatives are we taking to identify problem areas and how are introducing new plant inspection? Including SMEs. I think this is an area we take very seriously. In terms of our prioritization, we constantly think about which sectors should we prioritize. We also constantly conduct scoping studies in various industries to try and see if there are systematic barriers to entry for small businesses, if there's anti-competitive conduct. And a lot of those studies have helped in the past. To identify areas of anti-competitive conduct and where there's issues. One of the latest studies, two studies that we did recently, one was on the media sector, and that's yielded a few initiations into investigations in that sector where we're seeing problems. We also did a study on barriers to entry in private hospitals, because we're also seeing that one doesn't normally see new businesses coming in at a very high rate into that sector. And that's will inform some of the some of the analysis we would be undertaking in the market inquiry that's upcoming. So, through scoping studies and through these reviews, we are continually identifying new markets and new problem areas where we should be intervening. Thanks.
Thanks, colleague. I just wanted to propose there that on number 16, the new blood is an addition, the new blood into the sectors, SMEs and cooperatives. But in any other area where we are expanding SMEs, also include cooperatives so that we benefit the broad masses of people.
Thanks, Mr. Cooperatives. Just on a lighter note, Ms. Odette.
I thought the minimum budget is going to maybe get us on this new blood that it's got. It's got nothing to do with age, you know. Because I know people lose experience. So I thought it's going to raise a concern with that, but I think I'm covered.
Thank you very much. I guess that then brings us to the end of the session. Let me thank the Competition Commission for the responses on the questions that you've posed. It's quite obvious that the work that you're doing is very, very important to the nation. Hence, I think the types of questions that you were responding to, and even the type of engagement you had from members. Never underestimate the work that you're doing, and always look for improvement, how best you can, you know, serve your people, especially in these areas where we think people are not interested in. I always say, you shouldn't feel comfortable when you don't get questions. You always get easy questions, or only engage with people who are at another level and not the grassroots, because it means they know nothing about what you're doing, and therefore you might stand a chance of impacting less in their lives. And those are the people that we should be looking at and trying to impact, you know, largely on. I'm impressed by, you know, the interest or the understanding that you have now as compared to before on the role that you ought to be playing, you know, to change, you know, the life of our people for the better, including the role that you're supposed to be playing in the lives of the newly established entrepreneurs and small and medium, including the cooperative sector, that should be impacting on. I think this is where what we meant when we said the law gives you quite a broader mandate. It's up to you then to check as to how best can you play around in order to make it alive, you know, your mandate alive. You can do it in various ways. And the more people know, the more they'll be able to engage you, and the more, you know, exposed you will be, you know, better than what you think you are exposed in. Exposure is not only through those international trips, centers, and all that. Exposure is even here in South Africa where we are. Thank you for that understanding, and also for opening up, you know, for us to be able to advise you. That to us means a lot. Let me also thank the members for their participation. I know they work very hard to ensure that they understand the work that you're doing, and to end up giving you the advice that they're giving you. Don't take it for granted. And we also thank you for educating us, because each time we engage with you, we become better people, because we tend to know you better. You know your work better than we had known previously. Thank you for that. This is the relationship we're talking about. We are family, and we can only proceed or go a step forward if we move on the same understanding and wavelength. This meeting has been fruitful, and thank you very much for coming and also for your participation. And stands adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.